This is a special edition of Fresh Air devoted to the subject of AIDS. This epidemic will also be the subject of tomorrow's program. You're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia, and this is Fresh Air. There's currently no cure for AIDS and no vaccine to protect against contagion. This has led to many realistic fears as well as irrational hysteria. During the remainder of the program, we'll try to dispel the irrational fears and discuss how to prevent exposure to the virus. With me now is a panel of medical and social welfare experts to discuss how the disease is transmitted, safe sex practices, and how to safely help persons with AIDS. We'll also discuss the response of the social welfare system to the epidemic, and we'll hear the latest statistics of how AIDS has spread in Philadelphia and what is forecast for the future. The best means we have now to limit the spread of AIDS is education on how to avoid exposure to the virus. Because AIDS can be spread through intimate contact, much of that information involves sexual practices. Since this is an urgent health matter and we all have very important questions, we're going to have a very candid, explicit discussion about what is now being called safe sex practices. If you would rather not be exposed to this discussion, you might try tuning us back in about 20 minutes. I have three guests. Dr. John Turner treats many patients with AIDS. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University and is affiliated with Temple University and graduate hospitals. Dr. Robert Sherrar is an epidemiologist who's monitoring the spread of AIDS in Philadelphia. He's the director of the Division of Disease Control for the Philadelphia Department of Health. He's also an advisor on AIDS to the Mayor's Commission on Sexual Minorities. Roger Stevens is the chair of the Education Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. He's the director of social work at Graduate Hospital. He's the president of the Society for Hospital Social Work Directors for Eastern Pennsylvania. I want to welcome you all to Fresh Air. And I should mention that, time permitting, we're going to open up the phones for your questions a little later on in the program. Dr. Turner, let me start by asking you to give us a layman's description of what AIDS is.
Surely. By now, practically everyone in the United States has heard about and read about AIDS, and most people are aware that the initials stand for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, and that includes two of the most important features that we need to know about AIDS. That is to say, it is not a single disease, but we use the term syndrome to describe a situation where there is a breakdown, in this case, in the immune system or the part of the body's normal physiology that we use to counteract microbiological organisms in our environment, like bacteria and viruses and other organisms. This is a very complicated, interrelated system in the body that is controlled very finely under normal circumstances and allows us to even get over the common cold and other things that medical practice really is fairly helpless to specifically fight. But in a person who has AIDS, this is not possible because part of the immune system has been attacked and, in fact, destroyed by virtue of the activity of a virus that we now call HTLV-3. I don't want to get overly technical, but that is the specific virus that has been found to be associated with AIDS throughout the world, as a matter of fact, although it goes by different names in different places depending upon who described it. That means that people who have AIDS are susceptible to a long list of unusual infections. These are infections that healthy people ordinarily never get in an entire lifetime. They are similar to infections that can occur in other people whose immune system is damaged, for example, because they have diseases like leukemia or certain other kinds of cancers, or because they have received medication such as immunosuppressive agents that would be given, for example, to a person who has a kidney transplant in order to promote non-rejection of that kidney transplant. They are very similar to the diseases that do occur in those kinds of people, so the diseases themselves are not new. The specific kinds of infections have been known often for a long time, and for some of them there are treatments available, although that's not always the case. But in a person who has AIDS, there is a susceptibility then to repeated episodes of these very serious kinds of infections, and because they tend to occur one after another and because the immune system is further destroyed, ultimately there comes a time when even the best treatment available may not be effective. I should further mention, by the way, that the immune system is not the only part of the body that is attacked by this particular virus. It also lives in and attacks neurological tissue in the brain, the spinal cord, and in peripheral nerves throughout the body. And there are a host of different kinds of often debilitating and, in fact, sometimes fatal neurological diseases that occur in patients with AIDS. And finally, there are some unusual kinds of tumors that occur in patients with AIDS as well.
Dr. Robert Sharar, you're an epidemiologist, and you were just saying to me a few minutes ago, you were saying to me that AIDS is no longer a mystery. We know what causes it, and we know how it's spread. What we don't have is a vaccine or a cure, but it's not the mystery that it used to be. Now, when AIDS first became identified in America, there was a lot of hysteria about how it was going to be spread now. Now that we know more about AIDS, is there any way of spreading it through casual contact?
No, Terry, I would like to discuss briefly the modes of transmitting this disease because I think it's very important for the public to understand it. You're absolutely right. AIDS is no longer the medical mystery that it once was, and I think we should all realize that. It's true we can't treat it with a drug and we can't prevent it with a vaccine, but we certainly know how it's transmitted in the population. Now, we learn how a disease is transmitted within a population simply by looking at who gets the disease and who doesn't get the disease. Now, that's very important because that tells us how the disease is transmitted. And let me give you an example. When we look at who gets the disease, clearly about 73% of the cases have been gay men who've gotten the disease because of sexual activity. About 10% of the people have gotten the disease because of contact with contaminated blood. This would be through blood transfusions, factor VIII concentrate, or sharing IV needles. So that's the second mode of transmission. The third mode of transmission has been from the mother to the child during pregnancy or just at the time of birth. Now, who doesn't get the disease? You know, the medical profession has been providing care for these people for many, many years now, probably since the late 1970s, even before we knew we had a problem. And so far, no one in the medical field has developed AIDS because of occupational exposure. Secondly, we have studied a number of households and found that we're unable to document any spread of the virus within a household from one adult to another adult or from one child to another child through what we call casual, and by casual we mean non-sexual contact. And I think this is important. This is a disease that is not spread by casual contact. It is not spread by the airborne route, and there's absolutely no epidemiologic data to suggest that this disease can be transmitted by saliva or even by eating food that was prepared by an AIDS patient.
Okay, I'd like to discuss safe sex practices since one of the primary forms of transmission is through sex. Now, you just said, Dr. Sharar, that there's no real hard evidence of transmission through saliva. I think that's an opinion that's either still controversial or that's recently changed. Can you spread it through kissing? I really have heard mixed things about that, and I'd like all of your opinions since I thought this was something that the medical profession was still divided on. You're all nodding your heads.
Okay, Terry, let me just tell one story that takes place. There is a foster mother up in Newark that adopted twin daughters, and one of the little girls had received a blood transfusion at birth and had not been doing well. At 2.5 years of age, they discovered that that child had AIDS. The children are now between 5 and 6 years of AIDS, and the mother not only took care of these kids, but was kind of the local daycare center mother and took care of a number of neighborhood kids. And when they discovered that the individual had AIDS, the CDC and other people went in to study the family. And they asked the mother, what was it like raising these children? And they said, well, they slept in the same bed. They played in the same crib. They shared the same toys. When I changed one diaper, I changed the other. When I fed one, I fed the other. In fact, the healthy baby, when she finished her bottle, frequently grabbed the bottle from the sick one and finished that one. You know, it's this very intimate, close contact that takes place within a household and particularly among children. And they studied these children. They analyzed their blood, and they had absolutely no transmission from that child to anyone else in the family. Now, that tells you a lot. If saliva were a mode of transmitting the disease, you would expect to find transmission in this setting. It has not happened.
Dr. John Turner, you agree saliva is not?
I absolutely agree. There is no evidence whatsoever that salivary transmission has ever taken place.
Roger Stevens?
How could I disagree with these experts?
Okay, let's talk about different forms of intercourse. And again, I want to remind our listeners that we are going to be talking explicitly about this. It's an urgent health matter, and we're going to be talking about it explicitly so that you have some understanding about what you can do sexually that won't transmit the disease or make you vulnerable to AIDS. From what we know, is anal intercourse more risky or more likely to spread AIDS than heterosexual vaginal intercourse?
That question is perhaps somewhat difficult to answer. Again, perhaps because in the United States, the majority of patients to date have been homosexual men, and we therefore tend to assume that anal intercourse is a more efficient, if you will, mode of transmission of the virus. Let me point out that the virus exists in cells called lymphocytes, and these cells are present in prostatic fluid, which is in the ejaculate, and that is the mode of transmission of the virus from one person to another. It can occur through either receptive anal intercourse or receptive vaginal intercourse. And as you're aware, in Africa and certain other parts of the world, there is a relatively even distribution of women and men who have AIDS. And whether or not that's because of receptive vaginal intercourse as a mode of transmission in those areas or because the health standards in those areas allow injection of medications into numerous people using the same needle, or which of those two is the case, is somewhat cloudy at this point. But I think we need to say that both vaginal and anal intercourse, be that homosexual or heterosexual, can transmit this virus. And that really forms the basis for the recommendations for the change in sexual practices that we're talking about.
Now, it's my understanding that the virus has to enter through the bloodstream. If you're engaged in a sexual practice, do you have to have a slight cut or tear in the skin through which the virus would enter?
It is assumed that during anal intercourse that there are minute abrasions to the walls of the lining of the rectum, for example, that allow entry of the virus directly into either the lymphatic system or the bloodstream system, and that the virus enters that way. Similarly, that can occur theoretically through vaginal intercourse as well. And furthermore, at a time near the menstrual period in a woman, for example, there are blood vessels that are exposed theoretically for a period of time to entry of microbiological agents that could be exchanged through vaginal intercourse.
Now, if you are having anal sex, who is there a difference in the vulnerability of the person who's the active person and the receptive person in anal intercourse?
Statistically, there does appear to be a greater risk associated with being the receptive partner of anal intercourse. However, the risk is probably not zero for the active partner in anal intercourse or vaginal intercourse, for that matter. And that's why we would recommend, for example, the use of condoms as a means of blocking the transmission of the virus from one partner to the other in either direction.
Does that mean that that also that a man could get it from a woman who had AIDS through intercourse?
Theoretically, that is possible. There have been in the neighborhood of, Dr. Sherrar can correct me, but I think there have been maybe 50 or 60 reported cases of apparent heterosexual transmission from an infected woman to a man reported to the CDC. And although the precise mode of transmission, I think, needs to be worked out with some care, nonetheless, it probably can occur in that direction. Bob, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would, John.
Now, let me just stop and ask everybody if there's complete agreement with what's been said so far. Is there anything you'd want to challenge medically about the transmission of the disease of what we've heard so far? And there's plenty of questions left to follow. So
I would agree with John.
Okay.
I think the transfer of body fluids from one individual to another individual during sexual activity is what causes the disease to be transmitted from one person to the other. And I think it can occur with both rectal or vaginal intercourse.
Okay. Now we move on to the question of oral sex. Is oral sex as dangerous as far as giving or picking up the virus as intercourse is?
This is a very tough question. We've already, I think, dealt with the fact that we do not believe that salivary transmission is important. That is to say, you can't get it through kissing. Therefore, saliva would not transmit the virus through oral intercourse. Now, the virus be transmitted in the other direction? That is to say, could it be transmitted by swallowing semen? And the evidence to date suggests that, in fact, that is probably not a risk. Now, throughout the country, the various kinds of task forces similar to the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force, the various kinds of health bureaus and agencies and so forth have uniformly proscribed, that is, have argued against swallowing semen in order to stay the epidemic. These recommendations all came from a time even dating even before we knew that there was a specific virus involved, nor anything about the biology of the virus. Everybody has been very reluctant to relax that proscription against oral sex. But I think to be scientifically fair, we would have to say that to date it appears that oral sex is a minimal risk, if it is a risk at all. There have now actually been some researchers who have flatly stated that transmission does not occur that way, the reason being that they believe the virus is digested by the hydrochloric acid in the stomach.
Yeah, I would just like to expand that a little bit. Part of the problem, or one of the arguments to support the fact that oral sex might transmit the agent, is that people do have, you know, bleeding gums, and that it's possible for the agent to enter through the buccal mucosa before it even reaches the gastrointestinal tract, where it probably will be digested by the gastric juices. I think the only thing to be truthfully said there is that we simply don't know if it can be transmitted that fashion. And some people don't believe it. Others think that it might happen. And in either case, I think it's a sort of thing, since we are dealing with such a serious disease, that the people, I think, should err on the side of being conservative there and not swallowing semen.
Roger Stevens, you are the head of the education part of the AIDS Task Force, and through that work with Safe Sex discussions. Now, I'm sure everyone would agree that you should wear a condom during intercourse, any form, heterosexual, homosexual, anal, vaginal intercourse, whatever. But we all know that not every condom, although they're pre-tested, not everyone is really perfect. What do you recommend? I mean, do you recommend really putting your faith in that a condom is going to work and offer you protection?
I think it's good to look at it in terms of reducing risk rather than absolute protection. And obviously, the only absolute protection is absolute abstinence. That's not a viable alternative for most of our people we're trying to talk to. So we have to present things in the levels, different levels of protection. Obviously, a condom is a better protection than not, and that's the way we have to present it.
How effective is a condom in that? It covers the penis very well, but there are areas around the genital that also comes in contact with sexual body fluid. So are you really sure of being protected if, you know, a penis is sheathed with a condom?
I think if you block the transmission of the ejaculate from one person to another person, you have essentially blocked transmission. This disease is not transmitted by skin contact. So that the portion of the genitals that would not be covered would not really be transmitting the disease.
So everyone's in agreement that condoms are very wise to use. Is there, I don't mean brand here, but is there a certain kind of condom that you think offers better protection than another, or is it all the same? And I don't mean brand, but I mean material.
I think the important thing is that people learn to use them properly. Okay. And that means by putting them on early in the action and to make certain that they're not reused multiple times. I think to learn to use the condom properly is probably more important than which brand you use.
Is there enough pre-orgasmic semen to spread AIDS? In other words, should you put on a condom immediately upon making contact, making genital contact?
I'm not sure that we have the answer for that.
So you'd suggest erring on the side of caution?
Yes,
on that
I would.
One. Okay. Were you going to say something, Roger Stevens?
I think that erring on the side of caution is always the better way. And, take a very conservative approach to that question.
When you teach safe sex practices, what other things do you recommend people keep in mind, and what alternatives can you offer?
Well, also need to offer for gay men mutual masturbation and other types of activity, just simply hugging and kissing and so forth that are safe. And it's sometimes difficult to help people understand that can be satisfying. They have certain preconceived notions.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this is a special edition of Fresh Air. We're discussing the subject of AIDS. We're currently talking about safe sex practices, and I have a panel of medical and social welfare experts with me. Just speaking was Roger Stevens, who chairs the Education Committee of the Local AIDS Task Force, and he's the Director of Social Work at Graduate Hospital. Also with me, Dr. Robert Sherrar, an epidemiologist who's monitoring the spread of AIDS in Philadelphia. He directs the Division of Disease Control for the Philadelphia Department of Health. Also with me, Dr. John Turner, who treats many AIDS patients, and he's affiliated with Temple University Hospital and Graduate Hospital. We've been hearing a lot about promiscuity, how promiscuous people are more apt to get AIDS. At this point, given the amount of knowledge that we have now, which is a lot more than we had last year, is it the number of partners you have or what you do with those partners that makes you vulnerable to AIDS?
The number is probably not as significant as what you do. If you practice safe sex with each partner, then the number of partners is not the factor. It's the transmission of the ejaculate that is the carrier, and if that is the practice, then that's very, very clear.
Do we have agreement on that?
Well, I think, you know, the Public Health Service does recommend that the people limit their number of sexual contacts only because, you know, as we pointed out earlier, the condom is not 100% effective because it's not always properly used. And I think that, you know, one approach to safe sex is to be in a mutually monogamous relationship, and that does work for some people. So I think that my personal recommendation would be to limit the number of partners. But I think it is more important to use these safe sex techniques that were discussed earlier. You know, when the outbreak first began back in 1981, they did some studies that showed that the individual who was most likely to get AIDS was the individual that had the largest number of sexual partners. But now when you take a look at the data in terms of how widespread the virus or the infection is in the population, there is a cohort in San Francisco where 75% of the gay men who attend the VD clinic have been infected with the virus that causes AIDS. If you take that 75% and apply it to that select group, you realize that you only have to have contact with three other individuals, and you will have a greater than a 95% chance of being exposed to the virus. So, you know, you don't have to have large numbers of contacts anymore to become exposed to the agent. And that's why I think safe sex or the risk reduction techniques certainly become even more important.
I would like to underscore that because there are couples I see, for example, who have gotten together within the last 6 months or last year and have now what they define as a monogamous relationship and feel that they can relax what it is that they do. And I have to tell them that in point of fact, they have to assume until proved otherwise that one or both might conceivably be infected with the virus, since there's a very long incubation period before symptoms might become obvious, and in fact, many people are capable of transmitting the virus without ever becoming sick. And so even in a newly formed monogamous relationship, safe sex practices must still be utilized, and I think that's really much more important than focusing on the numbers.
Well, that brings us to the question of the blood test, which will determine if you've been exposed to the AIDS virus. Explain a little more what the blood test is before I ask you the question.
Well, there's a blood test that is available that has been erroneously assumed to be a test for AIDS, which it definitely is not. The test was developed with great rapidity and great urgency because there was the obvious understanding that the blood supply of the United States was in danger of transmitting this virus to large numbers of people, particularly those who received large numbers of transfusions, cardiac surgery patients, hemophiliacs, other people with major bleeding problems who received more than just a unit or two. There was tremendous urgency, therefore, in trying to screen potentially infected blood and discard those units, and this particular test was the first one that has been developed and utilized commercially. It's an antibody test, which therefore detects the presence of a protein in the blood of the person who may have been exposed to the virus. It has a number of drawbacks in terms of clinical use from one person to another, however. It's good for screening blood. That's fine.